Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. My name is Kevin Swanson. Coming to you from my basement out here in the Eastern Plains of Colorado. I'm a homeschool father of five children. We have been living out here 20-some years. Raising our children, of course, during the breakdown of faith, family, and freedom in the Western world. And we're fighting for a little progress out here in the Eastern Plains of Colorado. And Steve Vaughn joins me in studio today. Steve is a good friend of the program. He's been on the program a number of times. He's a father of six, homeschool father of six, involved in speech and debate and a lot of other things. Christian Home Educators of Colorado is on the board and has got a lot of other responsibilities. I can't remember all of them. And I'm sure you can't either, Steve.
I cannot.
Okay. But here he is. He's dropped by on a Wednesday to do some programs with us on the Generations broadcast. And it's good to have you with us, Steve. We're going to hit a couple of interesting stories here that tie into what's happening here in Colorado. This is from David Capelli in WorldNet Daily. We've had David on the program a couple of times. He's a good man. He deals with cultural issues, this time on drugs. 70 million Americans take mind-altering drugs. Starts out the article with the heroin overdose death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman has caused the media to focus, however fleetingly, on America's drug problem. Sadly, this actor, Philip Hoffman, died. He was actually a fairly talented man, but he died as a result of a drug overdose. News accounts of the Oscar winner's tragic demise typically reference the startling increase in heroin-related deaths in the last 4 to 5 years. The problem, reporters explain, is the vast number of Americans addicted to prescription pain meds like OxyContin, many of whom discover heroin to be both cheaper and easier to obtain than the prescription opioid drugs to which they initially became addicted. So apparently, Steve, people get addicted to these over-the-counter drugs and eventually wind up on heroin.
Yeah, because they just don't give what they're wanting, and so they need something heavier and heavier, more potent in order to achieve the same high that they got before. Mm-hmm. And so as their body becomes tolerant, they need to take more or something different. And so that's why they're getting onto heroin, and heroin's cheap.
Yeah, I guess it's cheaper. It's even cheaper. He says here, we discover that not only has the traditional distinction between illegal street drugs and legal therapeutic prescription drugs become so blurred as to become almost non-existent, but between America's twin drug epidemics, one illegal, the other legal, well over 70 million Americans are using mind-altering drugs. That number doesn't even include abuses of alcohol, which adds an additional 60 million Americans. So we're really talking about 130 million strung-out Americans. How is that possible?
Yeah, that's about half.
That's about half of America strung out, drunk, on drugs. I have a hard time believing that.
Well,
could it be David maybe exaggerating a bit?
Yeah, I wonder if there's some overlap between alcohol and drugs too.
I guess you could take both, right?
Yeah, so maybe it's 100 million rather than
150 million.
Yeah,
but whatever the case, that's a lot of people.
That's a
lot of people. That's even more people than attend evangelical churches.
That's humbling. That is
humbling, yes. Oh, man. It turns out also Americans are moving towards marijuana. I mean, stock prices of a cannabis company is soaring, according to David Capellian's article here. The demand for marijuana is insatiable, says one entrepreneur. You have a feeding frenzy for the birth of a new industry, the New York City-based publication High Times. I wonder if anybody reads that. Do you read High Times?
They may read it, but I don't know if
they're
remember.
Not getting much, right? They're not getting much. They announced a new private equity fund to raise $100 million for the next 2 years to invest in cannabis-related businesses, ad agencies geared up to support an industry estimated to already be generating revenues in the billions of dollars. I would never have believed that. Billions of dollars. Did you see the lines in downtown Denver? I think it was in Denver Post. There's lines and lines of people, as far as I can see, trying to pick up their marijuana on January 1st or January 2nd.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. As I drive down, sometimes I drive down Parker Road, Leechdale, you can see the cannabis shops there and the interesting names of them, you know, and, you know, it's, you know, they're there to help everybody.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm hearing our friend Bob, who's a contractor for our church, actually a church building. He says they're having a really hard time. The contractors are having a hard time finding anybody to work.
Yeah.
They're bringing them from New Mexico. I mean, the guys working apparently on our church right now, they've come up from New Mexico. They've had to bring in workers from New Mexico because they're having a hard time getting workers in Denver.
Yeah, I wonder why.
they're high.
That's right.
It's all legal now.
Right. So
having a good time.
Yeah. Do I have to work
now
for this?
I'm not an economist here, Steve, but what does that do to an economy? You know, what does it do to an economy? Again, none of us economists here in the just a couple of homeschooling dads trying to figure it out.
Well, I mean, they've got to eat. They've got to have a place to stay. And so, therefore, you know, our liberal government is going to help them out because, obviously, they can't find work. And so they're going to take the money from those who produce and give it to those who don't so that we can be compassionate.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's something like 150 million Americans on welfare now. 150 million people on drugs.
I wonder if they're the same people.
Yeah, yeah, it's a correlation here.
Yeah.
Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. I can't be good for an economy.
No, it
people
can't.
On drugs. Now, Steve, we've talked about this off air, this legalization of marijuana. And one of the lines I've used is out of the 647,347 things I would like to see legalized in a society that has practically illegalized and regulated everything, every cotton-picking thing. Practically, okay, there's so much regulation right now, it's almost impossible to function. So I have a long list of things I'd like to legalize.
Yes.
Yeah, now I know that the things the liberals want to legalize are killing babies and the worst forms of decadent sex.
Right.
Okay, but that's not on my list. As it turns out, that's on the other
that's
list.
That's on the other list.
Yeah. But yes. On my list of things that I think should be legalized, you know, marijuana's there somewhere, but I think it's down around 547,346. So,
right.
You know, I realize we live in a society that doesn't understand God's law, which, by the way, is not really super nitpicky on every single substance out there that doesn't create a bureaucracy in a police state. But it certainly doesn't emphasize the importance of legalizing drugs for the purpose of having a really good time.
Right.
Quote, unquote.
Yeah. And, you know, as we were talking off air before the show here, you asked me, you know, what my thoughts were. And, you know, I think there's a big difference between legalization and deregulation.
Yeah.
Because when you legalize something, you are basically giving your tacit approval. You're giving your stamp of approval saying that this is something that's good. This is something that you can do. Deregulation just says you're free. You have a freedom to do this. But the problem is if you're going to be free to do that, you need to be responsible for the consequences.
Yeah.
And so if you deregulate something and, you know, so marijuana or any of the other drugs, you get high, you go out and kill somebody. I think that's first degree murder and they need to be executed in a fairly rapid manner. But we don't have that.
Right.
So with society not having that set up, there's no way to deregulate.
Exactly. Why would you want to deregulate if you have a system that would just encourage, you know, this high level anarchy and the violation of some of these laws in a very severe sense? And when society turns anarchical on you because you don't have common sense laws on things like gross negligence,
right,
you know, backing over a kid in the parking lot at Safeway as, you know, you're high on marijuana, that is a gross negligence issue and ought to be dealt with severely by the courts, but tends not to be.
Right.
Tends
it's
not
the,
to be.
It's the victim's fault.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, you'll wind up with a guy serving 2 years for backing over the kid in the parking lot and somebody else is serving 2 years for, you know, spanking his kid.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, both of them get effectively the same thing with a law system that doesn't make any sense. It's not based in biblical law. And so, Steve, I think the point being that why should we deregulate marijuana when the rest of our laws are not really based in common sense and are not going to establish any level of structure and stability for society?
Yeah, there's no reason to at this point, because if you did that, just as you said, it would just encourage more and more people to get high and go out and kill people.
Well, that's what this guy says in this article. I'm hitting the article from David Kapelian and WorldNet Daily, and he says here that it's well documented that most perpetrators of school shootings and mass murders in a modern era, we're either on or just recently coming off of psychiatric medications, most commonly antidepressants. Hundreds of other criminal cases are documented here. And my guess is, and I know a number of police officers and one who happens to work in the Colorado Springs Department for Theft. He's a detective that works the theft department of Colorado Springs Police Department. And this guy says, you know, it's all drugs. It's all drugs. And, you know, you arrest people for theft, and typically it's drugs. I mean, they're guys on drugs that are stealing things And you know, biblical law would say, hey, somebody's out there stealing stuff. He repays 4 to 5 times the value of what he stole, and he's going to have to go into some form of forced labor in order to pay that back. And our little cushy little civil law system today doesn't provide much for restitution. And so these guys wind up on the streets again and again and again. In fact, one of the most frustrating positions in the economy today is to be a police officer for the Colorado Springs Police Department. I'm just telling you that.
Yeah.
I know a number of guys are police department guys, and they're pretty frustrated because they can't keep these guys off the street.
Well, and yeah, they let them go, and then they get uncomfortable out in the street, and then they do something to get back in because, of course, the jail system isn't all that horrible. They get their you know, 3 squares a day, cable, exercise equipment, you know, all kinds of stuff. And so why stay out of jail? Why, you know, what jail does is it teaches them to be maybe a little bit more careful the next time, and so they can stay out a little bit longer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty sad. They, you know, the Bible says, let him that steal no more, but let him work with his hands so that he has to give to him who has none. And that would include some form of repayment to the victims under that category of giving to them who have none. So the Bible actually does present, I think, a very, very commonsensical way of dealing with crime, something that our civil courts today know very little about. All right, so here's the article from David Capellian. He's concerned that there are 250 million prescriptions for antidepressants written every year.
Wow.
That's like one for every American.
Yes.
That's a lot. That is a lot. Wow. That's all I can say is wow. And a prescription is typically more than one pill, it's my guess.
Yeah, you would get your 30-day supply.
You think 30-day?
Yeah.
So let's say 30 pills, that would be upwards of 10, 20 billion antidepressant pills distributed to Americans in any given year. That's a lot of antidepressants. A lot.
Yes, it is.
That's a third to a half of Americans on antidepressants in any given year. Incredible. America has become a nation on drugs. And again, what do you think about this idea that Capellian brought up in the article here, Steve, that there's not a real thick line between that which is legal and illegal when it comes to these drugs?
Well, a lot of them do the same things as the illegal drugs do. And so, you know, basically you're trying to mask whatever it is that's hurting you, mm-hmm. and you're putting a Band-Aid on something. You're hiding what the real problem is, and that's, you know, a relationship with God, our creator. And so that leads to depression. If there is no reason for my existence except for to, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins. You go to public schools and there is no reason for you to exist, then why not be on drugs? You know, he who dies with the most toys wins.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we're crossing the line over from materialism to an escapism.
Right.
I mean, people find that materials will not satisfy them, and they have walked over the line of despair, as Francis Schaeffer put it, and there are way more people walking over the line of despair. Now, when Francis Schaeffer wrote this stuff, he was talking about the drug culture of the 1960s, but my guess is we've got way more drugs today than they had in the 1960s.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, by the time you have 150 million Americans on antidepressants or some form of mind-altering drug, you've got to conclude, friends, we've walked over the line of despair, and it may be the majority of Americans now that have taken something of an escape ramp off the highway of reality, and they have escaped reality because they can't stand reality anymore, because reality is inescapably relational, revelational of the true and living relational God, and they don't really want to have relationship with the true and living God. David Capellian ends the article with this: as America approaches the final stages of metamorphosis into a totally godless, drug-dependent state, legal, illegal emerge, the borderline disappears, just as the line between drugged and normal and between sanity and insanity becomes increasingly blurred. Finally, all becomes drug-induced madness, wherein man, cut off from true life and direction and meaning from within, becomes his own stupefied god. Well put.
Yes.
I think I could agree with that.
Absolutely.
Wow. That's pretty good. That's out of WorldNet Daily, David Capellian, just a couple of days ago. This is Kevin Swanson. We'll be back with more on the Generations broadcast. Steve in studio with me. Be back in just a moment. There is nothing our nation and our families need more than the Word of God. Do you want to build a family that will stand? Jesus said the wise man built his house upon the rock of Jesus' own words, and his house stood through the raging storms of wind and flood. In a world where families are coming apart at the seams, where there is little generational faith continuity, let's build our families on the rock of God's Word every day. Generations is sponsoring the Bible Family Conference on August 10th and 11th in Washington, D.C., with speakers Ray Comfort, Ken Ham, Steve Green, Joel Beakey, Douglas Bond, and yours truly, Kevin Swanson. We have organized tours that will feature this nation's biblical Christian roots, and we have secured tickets to the new 430,000-square-foot Bible Museum. Take your family through this museum and check out a huge collection of Bible artifacts, amazing archaeological discoveries, and a Bible in American History exhibit. It's the ultimate family vacation to Washington, D.C. this August. The Bible Family Conference happens the week of August 7th, sponsored by Generations.org. Registration prices start at $59, and early registration ends March 31st. Register at Generations.org. That's Generations.org. And we're back on the Generations Radio broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you. Steve Vaughn, also in studio with me. And Steve, you know, I have hit this subject for the last several broadcasts because I've gotten similar articles from Forbes magazine. Here's the Forbes magazine article I mentioned 2 days ago. Here is the Fox Business News article I mentioned like a day ago. And another article from the Atlantic magazine came out just this morning. My dad sent it over to me. Indisputable evidence that millennials have it worse than any generation in 50 years. I mean, Atlantic magazine and Time magazine have talked about how bad the millennial generation is. The most narcissistic, laziest, unluckiest generation, the me generation, all about me. And now we've got three more articles from Forbes magazine. This one, more college does not beget more economic prosperity. I mentioned that yesterday. Jobs outlook even more dismal for the young, a very depressing article. And then this morning, indisputable evidence that millennials have it worse than any generation in 50 years. And he's got his charts. He shows the baby boomers and the late boomers and the Gen Xers and the Gen Yers, and then he finds it gets to the millennials. And he shows that the millennial generation has the highest unemployment rate coming out of the chute than we did in the 1980s. Remember when we were graduating from college in the 1980s? And, you know, it wasn't the best time. The 82, 83, 84 time frame was not the best time. Improved. By the time you get to 87, 88, 89, you're getting into better years. But the early Reagan years, bad years, hey, they were better than they are today for the millennials.
Yes. Yeah, even though they were things kind of started tank, but that was, I think, from the Carter administration, and now Reagan was trying new things like cutting taxes and stuff like that. Of course, things were going to go down for a while, but once they started taking off, then at least we had the chance, and that was right about the time that I got out of nursing school, mm-hmm. and so I could pretty much go anywhere I wanted to, yeah. to work.
Yeah, I had no problem getting a job out of the chute, graduating in 1986 or 87, I believe it was. But here, indisputable evidence that millennials have it worse than any generation in 50 years when it comes to unemployment. It's the worst for any generation in 50 years. That's bad. That's really bad. And that's after, what, 3-4 years out of the last recession. So we still haven't recovered at all when it comes to the young millennial generation, the 18 to 28s. They have the highest unemployment rate. And now here we have an article from the Atlantic magazine complaining of this. Employers just don't want to hire these people. Why? Why would that be? Is that because
they're not drugs?
They're on drugs. Yeah. Yeah. But that ties into the previous story. Let me go back to the Pelion story about 150 million Americans on drugs. They're on psychotropics. I mean, yeah. Hey, you know, this, what, 10 times more boys on psychotropics now than were in 1990? That can't be good.
No.
I mean, I know of a sample size of one young man who was on psychotropics through the 1970s.
Okay? Yeah.
He was on psychotropics through the 1970s. He has not been doing well in the job market for the last 15, 20 years of his life. I've kind of followed this young man. He's kind of related to somebody I know.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's it going to be like when you have 20 to 30 times more of the young men on psychotropics than were in the 1970s, 1980s. This is going to be an interesting experiment to see what it's like to put a young man on psychotropics for a very long time and see how he functions when he's 35 years old.
Yeah. But back to your original question, I think a lot of that is that the employers realize that these students coming out of high school, out of college, really have no experience and nothing to offer. You know, I think, you know, this is my opinion, is that, you know, when I was growing up, when you were growing up, we had summer jobs. I actually worked through school. After school, I would leave school, go to the church. My dad was the custodian for the church we went to, and so I would walk from school to the church, start cleaning up the church.
Yep.
So we knew how to work.
Yep. I was working with my father when I was 14 years old, 15 years old. I was typing sermons at 14 or 15 years of age, typing sermons for my father, who would translate them into Japanese and issue or publish bilingual books on subjects like creation, evolution, repentance, faith, the law of God, you know, some of these basic, basic Christian concepts. My dad was a missionary. I was typing these books for my dad. I was also doing English lessons, conversational English lessons for Japanese kids when I was about 14 years old, 15 years old. I make $2.50 an hour, make 500 yen, 500 yen an hour. For some cases, I make 1,000 yen an hour. Occasionally, I'd make 2,000 yen an hour, which is really good pay for a 15-year-old kid in the 1970s.
Yeah, that was what I was getting, 250 an hour.
250 an hour, yeah. That's what I was getting. It was good pay, and I did a little newspaper delivery as well, and really did a lot of work. When I was in college, Steve, I'd have 5 jobs on the side.
Yeah.
As many as 5 part-time jobs on the side, as well as my college work. I was working some part-time work for engineering companies. I worked for radio stations, a number of radio stations. I worked for a wholesale organization that worked with hardware stores. I was a wholesaler for hardware stores. I can think of probably 10, 12 different jobs I was doing through my college years as I was paying off my college tuition. So you know, that's the kind of thing we were doing in the 1970s, 1980s. I think life has become a lot easier. I think what you're looking at with the millennial generation is the generation where you've got way more kids born out of wedlock. Okay. I mean, it's going to be a factor of 5-6 times what it was in the 60s and 70s when we were born. When we were born in the 1960s, 6% of kids were born outside of wedlock. Okay. By the time you hit the 1990s, you're up to 30-35%. Now it's at 42%. So that's going to have impact. And yeah, I know that Planned Parenthood and Margaret Sanger and all the rest really are excited about all of this premarital sex. I mean, they've been big time in favor of it for a very, very long time. And so the other side is really, really excited about the breakdown of the nuclear family. But economically, it's just not going to bear the fruit they hope.
No. And, you know, once you factor in abortion, you know, how many of those, you know, 100 and some million or however many millions it is now would have purchased houses, purchased cars and all of that?
Yeah.
God is judging us economically.
Yeah. And here's one more thing. The millennial generation is the first electronics generation. You follow me here?
Oh, yeah.
The first internet generation. Now let's see. Al Gore invented the internet. I'm trying to think what the year was.
Was it the
80s? It was like 89 or something. Yeah. So I'm trying to think when Al Gore invented the internet. But it came out in the early 1990s. I think I had my first email account in 95, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds about right for me.
About 95,
yeah,
96.
Dial up.
Okay, so the millennial generation. Yeah, exactly. My dad's still on dial-up, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my dad's on dial-up. And he emails me 7-8 times a day. I can't email him big pictures, though.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, okay, so the millennial generation is the first internet generation. They plugged themselves. Their brains are literally plugged into the matrix.
Absolutely.
I mean, they are plugged in, baby. They've got all the electrodes sticking out of their brains. And you've seen these people, right?
Oh, yeah.
They're working their cell phones, the little iPhone thing in restaurants, and they never talk to anybody. The first generation that is sucked into the internet. And the internet, of course, is really efficient at distributing pornography. We ought to add that to the mix. Because back in the 70s and 80s, if you wanted to get a porn magazine, it was behind the counters, way behind you had to ask for it.
Yeah.
Okay, now, and as a 15, 16-year-old kid, it was probably not something you'd do. I mean, there was X percent of kids who had access.
Yeah.
But now, 80% of kids, boys 16 to 24 years of age, are addicted to pornography. Okay.
Yeah.
According to Covenant Eyes, they're hitting porn on a weekly or a monthly basis. And if that be the case, they are implanting all the images necessary to destroy their sex life in the years to come.
Yeah. And when you take a look at what goes on in the brain with any type of pleasurable activity, your brain doesn't recognize whether or not you have actually done anything or not. You have dopamine that transfers between, and dopamine is addictive. And when you have dopamine transferring in your neurons in your brain, and you have an excess of that through either video games, through movies, through pornography and all of that, then the only thing that your brain can do in order to cut down on the receptorship of this is to break down the receptors, and therefore you need more in order to get the same feeling. Now, you may have gotten to level 15 of whatever game you're playing, but in the real world, you've not done anything, but your brain thinks that you have.
Yeah.
And therefore, you need to go back and do those things again and just do more and more of them to get the same feeling, when they should be out building things and doing things with their hands to get that same dopamine feeling that is not going to be an overshoot of everything that, you know, in your brain to get you addicted, but you then end up getting the satisfaction out of the work that you do, and that then produces your wanting to do more. Right. God designed us to work and to accomplish and be satisfied with things that we do with our hands and do with our, things that we accomplish in the real world.
Well, and if you look at the millennial generation, they have the electronics generation, which means they're the distracted generation.
Exactly.
They think they're doing something, but they're in effect not doing anything super productive, and also not being super responsible. You know, it's interesting. Sexuality within marriage involves responsibility,
yes,
which means go get your pants on in the morning, get a job, and provide for your family. You know, you don't have that relationship with the porn star on the
right
screen. You follow me? I mean,
right.
No one needs to get a job for her, except, I suppose, to pay for the $2 a month or whatever necessary for the sign up. So, no, it's a crazy, crazy world, Steve. I mean, This is way, way, way further down the track towards the crossing the line of despair than we were in the 1960s, 1970s. Yes, it was Francis Schaeffer talking about this, saying we were crossing the line. We're way over the line, and this has hit the hoi polloi. This has hit the masses today, and I think the effects are going to bear on the economy. You know, who wants to hire a distracted kid who can't focus on a productive job, but is constantly flitting from one website to the next and can hardly focus on anything for more than 10 seconds at a time? And, you know, he sits in the interview and texts throughout the interview. That's,
right.
That's really a bad sign. You don't want to hire that guy. And here's one more problem. Barack Obama came up with the brilliant idea to push hard the raising of the minimum wage across the entire United States.
Oh, that's
going to
help.
At least for federal jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. So let's raise the minimum wage. And there's a number of states that have done this recently. And this, is, of course, will be the coup de grace for any millennial getting a job. And
right.
Any millennial getting hired by anybody who wants to hire him.
If they're not attractive now to hire.
Yeah. If they're not attractive at $10 an hour, they're not going to be attractive at $14 an hour.
No.
Sorry.
Not at all.
It just doesn't work that way. Okay. The craziness of what's going on around us, friends. And yet, true solutions. What are the solutions? Give your children the book of Proverbs. Teach your children God's word as you rise up, as you lie down, as you walk by the way, as you sit down in your house. And we encourage you to regular family worship. Disciple your children. If there's ever been a time where parents need to come home, disciple their children as they sit in the house, as they walk by the way, as they plow their fields. Now's the time to do it. And we really encourage people to our Proverbs Bible study guides as really the basic wisdom that really trumps what the millennial generation is doing, whatever that is. It's really cool. The book of Proverbs, really, 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 really good stuff. Not just read it, but to apply it. And that's one reason why I put these things into Bible study guide form. And I've got lots of application questions where parents can bring these things out and find ways, neat ways in which they can apply the principles of God's word to their children's lives as they sit in the house, as they walk by the way. And Steve, one more thing, the Family Economics Conference is. I mean, we want to dedicate the next Family Economics Conference to this problem. You know, day after day, I've got articles all over my desk from Forbes magazine, Atlantic magazine, Time magazine, Fox News. Hey, the millennial generation is one unlucky generation. And we wouldn't just say unlucky. We would say a cursed generation. We would say a generation that is up against major impediments. And I think there are ways through this, certainly by the application of biblical discipleship, mentorship, and the sorts of things we talk about at our Family Economics Conferences. The next one's coming up at the end of March in the Denver metro area. And oh, by the way, at the end of the conference, I'm inviting everybody over to my house. I'm just come on down to my house. We'll have pizza or something. And we're gonna hang out at my house on a Sunday afternoon after the conference. But friends, we're talking about real problems. I mean, real problems that our children are confronting today. And all day Saturday, we're going to deal with the issue of the millennial generation and our young men who have an incredibly difficult time getting into the macroeconomy, getting a job, getting a family, making a living. That's way more difficult than it was for us in the 1980s. So parents who care about these things are going to have to start discussing these things. And that's why the Family Economics Conference that we have scheduled for Denver in March. And for more information, it's familyeconomics.com. You're coming, Steve?
Unfortunately, I'm busy that week.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. But I'm going to try to make some of the other ones throughout the rest of the United States.
Hopefully you can. Yeah, we're scheduling another 3 to 4 over the next year or two.
Yeah, I'm bringing my coffee.
All right, good enough. Well, yeah, you've got a great business going with that coffee.
Yeah.
It's good stuff. Okay, my friends, Family Economics Conference at our Denver location coming up in March, the last weekend of March. And for more information to register, it's familyeconomics.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.